The Roswell UFO incident was the apparent recovery of extraterrestrial debris, including alien corpses, from an object which crashed near Roswell, New Mexico, in July of 1947.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
Well, since the late 1970s, the incident has been the subject of intense controversy and the subject of theories as to the true nature of the object which crashed. The United States military maintains that what was actually recovered was debris from an experimental high-altitude surveillance balloon belonging to a classified program called Mogul. However, many UFO proponents maintain that, in fact, a crashed alien craft and bodies were recovered and that the military then engaged in a cover-up. In a moment, we will be talking with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, and then later on, a witness to Roswell on Coast to Coast AM. And later on tonight, we'll be talking to the last surviving member of the B-29 crew that flew the apparent alien bodies out of the Roswell Army Airfield back in 1947. Two guests now, Tom Carey, Don Schmidt. Tom, of course, has been a Mutual UFO State Section Director in southeastern Pennsylvania, a special investigator for the J. Allen Hynek for UFO Studies, and a member of the CUFO's Board of Directors. Tom began investigating the Roswell incident in 1999 for the Roswell investigative team of Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, whom I'll introduce in a moment, and since 1998 has teamed exclusively with Don to pursue a proactive investigation. Here's Tom Carey back on Coast to Coast. Tom, how are you?
How are you, George?
Good. I'm looking forward to this tonight.
Just one small correction. I've been investigating the Roswell case since 1991.
Okay.
I think you said 1999. So it's 1991. It'll be 19 years this month.
You got it. Okay. And Don Schmidt, former co-director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. He served as a director of special investigations for 10 years. And prior to that, he was the special investigator for the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek, also for the International UFO Reporter. And here is Don Schmidt back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Don.
Hey, George. So good to be back with you again.
Likewise. We'll bring in a very special witness in about 15 minutes or so, and I'll have you two tell us a little bit about him.
But, we'll have to wake him up, right?
Yeah, we'll get there. Late hours for people, huh? Hey, let's go back. Let's review, both of you. How did you both become interested in UFOs in general, Roswell specifically? Tom?
Well, George, like a lot of UFO, people interested in UFOs, I got interested when I was a kid. My older brother had read things such as newspapers, which I didn't.
They're not doing that now either.
Right. And he said, hey, Tom, listen to this. And he would describe an incident that would appear in the local newspaper. And it just caught my fancy. I can't explain why, but I just thought it was something really unusual and interesting. And that interest really never faded. I read my first book, I think it was the Ruppelt book in 1956.
Report on unidentified flying objects.
Yeah, report on unidentified flying objects, and that really made it take off for me. And as far as the crashed UFOs, I guess, you know, you get tired, at least I do. I'm sure the people who see the various things in the sky don't feel that way. But for me, the lights in the sky phenomenon just doesn't do it for me.
I know. And I understand. You want something else. You want something more concrete.
Yes, I'm a nuts and bolts type of guy. Yeah. I have a straight line thinking. When people start talking about, well, maybe they're from our future or, you know, something like that, about my eyes glaze over. I'm sort of a straight ahead type of guy. And in 1980, I read the Roswell incident book, which was the first one on the case. And I said, wow, this you know, this is just tremendous. Talking about actual nuts and bolts artifacts, and not only that, but alien cadavers as well. And ever since then, it's been the Roswell case for me.
Yeah, I'm like you, Tom. You know, when I get these calls and cases, I want to see these craft land. I want to see somebody who says, I saw bolts and rivets in the thing.
Yes.
You know, you want to see that.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
You know, a light that zooms by is, you know, that's not going to do much for you.
Right. Well, take the Stevensville sightings, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah, down in Texas.
Very good sightings, but it's sort of nowhere now. Just a very good sighting. I still don't think they've explained it, but it doesn't move the phenomenon forward any.
How about you, Don Schmidt? How'd you get interested in studying UFOs and investigating?
Well, I can't imagine not being interested in it. I mean, talking the biggest story of the millennium in any one of these reports, all it takes is one to be true, and we solve it overnight. But I came into it very skeptical. In fact, even working with Dr. Hynek was quite the agnostic. We used to explain cases that even left him puzzled at times, and he was always quick to bounce opinions off of us, and we always had the alternative explanations. And it was certainly the case with Roswell. In fact, as Tom described, having even read the first book, Roswell Incident, I had not. I just could not accept that something of this magnitude could be kept a secret after all that time. And even our first trip down to New Mexico in the beginning of 1989, we thought we'd, you know, simply wrap this up in a weekend. You know, we'd come away with it being a weather balloon or something just as conventional. But then we started to talk to the first-hand witnesses, and testimony that would suffice in any court of law would be accepted as far as just by the sincerity, the credibility of the witnesses involved. And we came away, you know, with this position that we better quickly come up to speed, because what if? What if we're wrong? And so here it is, 9 years after the book came out, and I'm first reading Roswell Incident, as Kevin Randall at that time as well. And we had to admit we were wrong. And here now over 100 trips, you know, more to New Mexico and practically to every state across the country, tracking down these eyewitnesses. And then hence, you know, even the title of our current book, Witness to Roswell. You know, we're speaking for these people. We're, you know, serving as spokespeople for people no longer with us, most now passed on.
Oh, sure. There's only less than a handful, I think.
Handful, but we are still hot on the trail because we realize we're on the 5-yard line, so to speak.
What happens when these witnesses have passed on, and if we haven't truly uncovered the story to the point where government will admit it, do we lose it, or can we still pound away at it?
We, I've thought about this, George. We've mostly right now we're speaking to the surviving relatives of the actual witnesses, and they are, you know, oftentimes where the principal witness, if they were still alive, would not talk to us. The surviving relatives will. So that's a little bonus to consider. Yes, they are passing on, and I would say right now there's no more than 5% perhaps still alive. The principal witness, Mac Brazel, died in 1963.
Yeah,
that's a long time ago. And I've told Don often that we see the case passing before our eyes, but we have to stay on it because it's too important. It's the best case we have, and for me, and certainly for Don, it's the most interesting case ever, and that's what really holds our interest, is that the case has everything. But we were not going to let this go until A, we pass on, B, we find a piece of absolute incontrovertible physical evidence, or C, I forget what C is. But
well, those let's say government admits.
The government would confess. The government would fess up.
Right.
So to speak.
Which they're never going to do.
No, I don't think so either. I've gotten into friendly arguments with Stephen Bassett about disclosure.
As we have.
And I just don't think government's going to come out and say it. They're just not.
One of the reasons, and Don and I have talked about this, is one of the reasons they're not going to come forward on the UFO phenomenon is because they don't want to have to answer questions about what they did at Roswell. They committed crimes at Roswell to cover it up. They are never going to admit that. And for that reason, they are not even going to come clean on the total phenomenon because they don't want to answer about Roswell.
Didn't they threaten witnesses?
Well, precisely, the culpability. And it's something we've even talked to Stan Friedman about, which he agrees that there would be hell to pay. And I mean, violations even against the Constitution, the fact that the government used the military to actually threaten, and possibly worse, its own citizenry, and even down to children, as you've heard the stories, George, the fact that children were told, you will never see your parents again. Again, over a simple weather balloon device, an upper atmospheric surveillance device, as Mogul was. And here it is now 63 years later. And these people still feel intimidated. They still question as far as the loss of their pensions and the very protection of their loved ones regarding this. They still have this deep, dark secret, this sinister element to this whole case. And to us, it also makes the ultimate cold case file, the idea that there were crimes committed. There were people's rights violated. And as one officer suggested to us around that time regarding some of the accidents reported in the local press, he kind of joked that they weren't all accidents.
The mortician, Glenn Dennis, he's getting way up there in age now, isn't he?
Yes, he's very frail. I believe he no longer comes to the museum. He's one of the founders, one of the three founders with Walter Hout and Max Littell. Both Walter and Max are gone, and Glenn is very frail. And
I think I met him at the 60th anniversary of Roswell, and that was several years ago.
Yeah, yes. He still would have been up and about at that time. He's in a full care facility. We had hoped to even visit with him this past December and most likely to even say goodbye after all the years. And our association with Glenn goes back to 1990.
Tell us this incredible story of Glenn Dennis, the mortician. What happened to him? What did they ask him to do? What did he see?
Well, Glenn, his story is that he started receiving phone calls. He was an embalmer, mortician embalmer, mm-hmm. at the Ballard Funeral Home in 1947. I believe he was around 22 years old at the time. Started receiving phone calls from the airbase south of town about how to treat animals or living tissue that had been living that was out in the desert for several days, and also if they had any child-sized caskets. And Glenn said that, well, they had one in stock, but they could get more from Amarillo, et cetera, et cetera. So he kept receiving these calls throughout the day from the airbase about how to treat beings that had, or someone who had been dead lying out in the desert. And they finally said, have you had a aircraft accident? I'll get my stuff and I'll be right over. And they said, oh, no, this is just for future reference.
Yeah, they didn't want him to see anything, did they?
They did not want him to see anything. Well, to cut to the chase, the Ballard Funeral Home also had the ambulance contract with the airbase. The hearse doubled as an ambulance. So I don't know. I would want to be taken to the hospital in a hearse. That would not be a good
omen.
good thing.
No.
Anyway, Glenn took an airman, an injured airman, to the base hospital the day that the impact site north of town was found. This would be July 7, 1947. And he noticed that the hospital area was buzzing with people he did not recognize, medical people. And so he goes in there and drops the injured airman off, and he runs into a nurse friend of his who says, Glenn, you better get out of here. She's coming out of a side room with a towel over her face because she's coughing and wheezing, and she says, you better get out of here. You're going to get into trouble. And just then someone says, hey, you, who are you? And he says, well, I'm the mortician, blah, blah, blah. And they said, well, you better get out of here. This is the famous red-haired captain who I think we found. Don can address that. But so they escorted Glenn Dennis out of there in a rough manner and told him to get back to the Ballard Funeral Home. And they followed him all the way back. And all this time, Glenn is saying, you can't do this to me. I'm a civilian. You cannot do this to me.
Yeah.
And they say, well, we'll show you what we can do to you. And they just physically removed him from the hospital and sent him back to town.
And this nurse was distraught, wasn't she?
The nurse was distraught. She was just beside herself. And the next day, they met in the officers' club. And Glenn wanted to find out what was going on. And she said that there had been an attempted autopsy of alien bodies that had crashed north of town in a UFO. Like they called them flying saucers back then. And she was still distraught. She didn't touch her food. And she drew for Glenn a picture of what they looked like on a prescription pad. And, you know, the classic, you know, large head.
The grays, right?
Yeah, the classic grays. And so she drew that, and she says, I got to leave now. I'm sick. Well, Glenn never saw her again. He kept contacting the where the nurses stayed, and he was finally told that she had been transferred.
Well, we really don't know, do we?
No. Now, that's his story. His story has come under,
scrutiny?
Scrutiny. I was trying to – intense scrutiny by skeptics. And he gave us a name for the nurse of this Naomi Maria Self.
You were never able to find her.
We were never able to find her. A lot of capital was expended in trying to locate her. And finally, someone went to Glenn. Glenn, we cannot locate this Naomi Maria Self. There's no record that she was ever a nurse in the Army or Air Force or military or anybody by that name. He says, well, they gave you the phony name. They gave you a phony name.
Why did he do that?
Well, the story he gave to us, and we've quizzed him often on this, is that he promised her that he would never reveal her name. That's the story he gave her that he gave us, that he promised her. We don't buy it. We never. Well, maybe at one time we did, but after the investigation, we don't buy that. Don can fill you in on what we found regarding the nurse, because we do believe we have found her.
Okay, let's talk about that. And also, we're going to be bringing in Arthur Osipchuk. How old is he now?
He is 86.
86 years old. He's the last surviving member of that flight, right?
Yes, there was a B-29 flight. There were two flights flying out the bodies.
Okay, we're going to come right back. We're going to have you, both of you, set the stage for Arthur, and then we'll have him for just a half hour. And then we'll get back with Tom and Don as well throughout the night here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. Next hour, we'll pick up on that nurse story that we were talking about, who came out of the hospital and talked to the mortician, Glenn Dennis, about what he saw. Tom and Don, we've got Arthur on the line, and before we bring him in, let's have you explain to us who he is and what happened.
Well, the important point we need to emphasize is that what Arthur is ready to describe happened the day after the famous weather balloon press conference at Fort Worth. This was the afternoon, whereas that very morning, all the banner headlines explaining this all away is nothing more than a weather balloon. So everything had quieted down. Everything had returned to normal. General Ramey essentially chastised, you know, those idiots over at Roswell, albeit in charge of the atomic bomb, they couldn't tell the difference between a weather balloon and something truly.
And he had all those things spread out all over the place, right?
In his office, in front of his desk, correct. Clearly a weather balloon device as displayed to the press. But the witnesses say otherwise. Now, it would be the very next afternoon, about 3 in the afternoon, and it was a flight crew. They were on the Skeet Range. And they were notified that there was a special flight that they needed to be briefed and conduct a pre-flight on to go out within an hour. And once that was accomplished, there was a B-29, specifically tail number 7301. And we know that because one of the crewmen actually saved the manifest, the flight log, from that non-flight. And the plane was called the Straight Flush. And they would taxi over bomb pit number one, where typically they would keep one of the atomic bombs. And the pit itself was only visible from the air traffic tower and, you know, some areas of the flight line. But waiting as they approached was a sealed, unmarked, rectangular wooden crate, and it was under heavy guard. In fact, there were 6 guards, and they would taxi over the pit. The crate would be loaded into the bomb bay. The guards would accompany the crate, and from there they would fly and make a one-hour flight directly to Fort Worth, the very same military base, Carswell Army Airfield, that they had the weather balloon press conference just the day before. And it was a bombardier on that flight by the name of Felix Martucci. When they landed, he recognized amongst the officers waiting on the tarmac a mortician that he had gone to school with years before. Now, why would a mortician be waiting for this rectangular crate, which was hidden in bomb pit number one? Now, Arthur was a tech sergeant at that time. And he was on that very flight. And we had the good fortune of talking to some of his crew members, the late Lloyd Thompson and Robert Slusher, who just passed away. And they've all been able to describe these very details. So why don't we toss it to Arthur from here?
Let's bring Arthur in, Arthur Osipchuk. And Arthur, hello, sir. How are you? Good morning.
I'm fine, thank you. How about you?
Thank you. Thank you for serving, by the way. Tell us a little bit, Arthur, how old were you when all this happened?
Well, I can't remember. I went in the Army in 41, and I was about 20 then. And of course, this happened when I was in 47.
Right, so about 26 years old.
Somewhere in the years.
Tell us about the flight. Tell us what was going on at the time.
Well, what happened, like you said, we was at the Skeet Range, and then all of a sudden, Captain Ewing told us to come with him, and we had to go to the flight line, and we thought we had to make a flight test on a B-29. We put on a flight gear, and instead of a pre-flight, we was taken to the pit. We load up atomic bombs, and the plane was a B-29 straight flush.
Mm-hmm.
It was over the pit. The personnel over the pit, the MPs, kept us away and not to get near the B-29 while they were loading. And this kind of shocked us because we had top secrets. As far as you would go, we load up the bombs, and, of course, when the flight refused it and everything else.
Yeah, that was unusual. You were always close by that plane, weren't you?
Yes. And anyway, then after it was all done, they had the bomb bay doors closed, and then they told us we could get on board, and then we took off, and, of course, we went to Fort Worth. We didn't even know we was going to Fort Worth. And we stayed, of course, at low level. And, of course, then when he landed, we knew he was at Fort Worth. And to our surprise, they told us not to get off that aircraft.
What did you think, Arthur, was aboard that plane?
Well, it was shock to us because, of course, that incident happened, that flying saucers, and there was rumors there was a flying saucer and everything else happened around then. And then, of course, they said there was bodies at the hospital and that the nurse passed out and they were looking for Undertaker boxes for Chow. And, of course, this we couldn't believe anything. But I can recall this. They called one time, they called us, all this incident happened. They called all the flight crews at headquarters at a meeting. They said there was no such thing as flying saucers. The ones that did, they were braggers, or they were off the rockers, and we'd probably be psychoanalyzed. And they told us all this stuff at the time.
So they're trying to get you all to back off anything that you might have been hearing at the time.
Yes, that's correct. But anyway, when we was coming back, I noticed it was Martucci, one of them on the crew. Exactly, I don't know who it was. He said, we made history. I don't know, it was the pilot, one of the crew members says, we got to keep our mouth shut. We won't talk about it anymore. We cannot even tell our wives about this. Because if we did, we'd be sent to Fort Worth for the rest of our lives. And I kept quiet about this, which was so surprising. Until after quite a few years later, I went to a convention, 8th Air Force convention banquet, and I was at my table, and someone came in my ear, whispered in my ear, and I was kind of surprised and said, Ozzy, you definitely took bodies to Fort Worth, Texas. And he took off, and I don't know who the heck he was. And how he knew this information, we're supposed to keep our mouth shut about all this information.
Absolutely. Okay, and at what point, Arthur, did you ever see what was inside the crate?
No, they wouldn't allow us in there.
Now, how big was the crate? Try to describe the size for us.
Well, what happened? They sealed everything off. They even hid the crate from us.
Okay.
We was a flight crew, and that's why we were so shocked. Why was it so top secret?
The plane back there, the cargo area for that plane, could carry something how big in terms of dimension size?
I can't remember the size of the bomb. Well, the atomic bomb was pretty good size. They had two bomb bays, and I'm pretty sure it was on the front bomb bay. They loaded on it. Atomic bomb was a pretty good size bomb, and that had to be a pretty good size box or crate, whatever it was on there. I didn't ever see it because it was roped off. They didn't even want to see us. We were so surprised and shocked. Why not?
I mean, was the bay back there, could it fit a car, for example?
An automobile?
Yeah. Would that fit back there?
No, not in that bomb bay. Okay. Bomb bay wasn't that big.
Okay, so something smaller. So maybe not a craft, but maybe there could have been possibly bodies in the box?
Yes, that's what we believe. We were told by rumors, and you know how rumors fly. I just wondered how they kept the bodies from spoiling. They must have used dry ice or something. We thought all that information.
So when you landed in Fort Worth, you're told what? Stay on the plane?
Correct.
Don't get off. Somebody unloads the plane, right?
Yeah, they had a crew that unloaded, yes.
Were you able to look out the windows, or could you see anything as they were carting this box away?
No, we was in blisters, too. I don't know if the pilot or co-pilot could see, but we was in the blisters in the back. And
all right.
They had it covered up. They removed it. We didn't see nothing.
And at what point, Arthur, that after they unloaded it, did they have you fly out again?
Just when they had unloaded it, we took off.
So they didn't even let you stay?
No, no. We flew off immediately.
Okay. As you fly out, you're with your crew members. How many on the plane at the time? Do you remember?
Well, we got a bombardier and a
pilot.
Navigator, pilot and co-pilot, and an engineer, and top gun and two scanners.
So a pretty good-sized crew.
Yes.
All of you at some point had to start saying, what the heck did we carry over here, right?
Yeah, we were surprised, too, because we did a lot of top-secret stuff. We'd go to different bases, landed at an airfield, didn't know what we was carrying, and unloaded, and then we'd fly back to another base, then we'd fly back to that base, and then back to Roswell. And this really stumped us, because we were so shocked, because we bought top-secret and everything else. They didn't let us nothing know on it what was in that box. They wouldn't tell us.
Here we are now, Arthur, almost 63 years later?
That's about 63. We'll be 61.
What do you think was in that crate?
Well, I have an open mind. I feel there's something that was pretty top secret, but this has been so long. Why don't they let this information out? I heard there's, you know, I guess everybody's heard it was at Wright-Patterson. They were supposed to take the bodies up there from Fort Worth.
Right.
And put them in a deep freeze up there somewhere.
Yeah, I thought maybe you folks flew on to Wright-Patterson. You didn't.
So no, we didn't.
So you went back. Had this been a weather balloon, Arthur, would they have done this to you guys? Would they have kept it that secret from the crew?
Well, you know, I tell you what I thought, you know, because this is my own opinion. When they mentioned the weather balloon, you know, they said there was no such thing as flying saucers in the boys, but you know there was some secret in that box. And I thought they might have used it. Not mannequins, I thought they might have, for high altitude bailouts.
Yeah.
They had the B-36. I thought they might even use cadavers for experiments, but I imagine they used cadavers or mannequins on there for secret for bailout. We thought of that.
I had heard rumors that they might have had, you know, the war was over, but they might have had Japanese POWs, short POWs, and that they experimented with them. Something went wrong, and they had to cover it up. Did anybody ever talk about that at all out there at that time?
No, I never heard of that. But I thought when they said weather balloon and they said high altitude, I heard the rumors they was experimenting with high altitude balloons for B-36s to bail out. And then we heard they had a weather balloon to check for radiation for when Russia was going to top that atomic bomb.
Yeah.
We thought that might be. And then, of course, there were so many rumors flying.
Arthur, what would you have done had you gone back there and they opened up the crate and you would have seen three alien bodies there from another planet?
They would have shocked me pretty good. but I remember at the time when this all happened, there was a rancher at that time was rumored that he'd seen some craft crash. They had said there was bodies underneath it. Then they shut him up after a couple of weeks.
At any point afterward, after you and your crew came back, did any more stories start filtering out what this could have been or what was going on out there?
No, they explicitly told us, don't ever say anything, not even to our wives. They really did. And then they kind of put the brainwash, and they kind of brainwashed. You know, I never did tell my wife anything about a wife on until Tom Rose was writing a book, and he called up here, I can't remember, 5 or 6 years ago. And then he came on the air, and then one of my sons seen it on the History Channel.
Yeah.
And that's the only time he ever opened up on it. I was surprised.
Now,
that's how long I kept secret about it.
Here you are now, in this point in your life. Do you believe that this planet was visited, maybe at least in 1947, from a craft from a different world, crashed, and we recovered it, and we recovered their bodies? Do you think that happened?
Well, I'd give almost 80% on that something did happen. And even you go to the historic time of the Mayas and in South America, how that stone was cut by precision instruments. No man could have cut it that much without surgical instruments to cut that rock.
It would not have surprised you, though, if they had said, Arthur, we have some alien bodies from a spaceship. You would have probably said, I figured that.
I would go along pretty good at that. It would complete my 100% belief in it.
Arthur, if you guys had flown out the bodies possibly, what do you think might have happened to the crash craft? Where did that go?
This was a surprise to me because they had to have maintenance crew, you know, pick up the debris and everything. And, of course, we heard it was in the hangar, some of the debris. But we never heard anything from the ground personnel, you know, about picking up that aircraft. But on the base, on the news media and stuff like this, they said they found a piece of metal that had glyphics on it.
Yes.
All that stuff.
Did you know anybody personally that might have picked up some pieces or anything like that?
No, I haven't. But I heard I heard rumors that someone did pick up some pieces on a metal. they said you could bend it and come back out and
right.
That was hard for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm from Missouri. I'm not from Missouri, but the only Missouri you say, I believe only you can see it.
That's what they say in Missouri. No doubt about that. Did you live out that way, or you were just stationed there for a little bit?
I was stationed there for about 7 years.
Seven years. Okay. And even later on, even though you guys didn't talk about this, did you hear rumors whenever you guys went out or you go into town, people talk about this?
No, not at that time. It was a well-kept secret.
It sure was. Sounds that way.
Yes, it was. Matter of fact, I even thought you could get it out of my mind until I came up here for 5-6 years to Tom, and I believe who was the other one?
And
Don, I guess.
Yeah.
About making that book.
Yeah. Now, the fact that government kept this a secret, how do you feel about that? That they just held back, they didn't tell you folks, they didn't tell you.
This was always boggled my mind. Why don't they say something about it? Remember about the flying saucers, about the Blue Book. I'd like to add something else here. Just about 3 months ago, Italy called from Italy, and he's an author writing a book on if there's other people in outer space. And he's writing a book about it. So they believe strongly that there's people in outer space. They believe in something like flying saucers. He asked me what I knew about it.
Was he calling from the Vatican or just from a writer from Italy?
Matter of fact, he was calling from Italy. He was an interpreter for the guy that's writing this book.
Ah, okay.
And you notice also that even the Pope is trying to find out there's people in outer space.
I think so, too. He may already know, Arthur. He may already know.
And you notice here about a week ago on the news they saw an unidentified object flying in the sky. It was on TV.
Yeah.
Did you hear about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So there must be something going on.
Every time you see stories like this now of UFOs and things like that, do you sit back and go, I know it's true?
I know that something has to be. It has to be.
Well, the fact that you and your crew may have flown out three extraterrestrial bodies has got to be just, that's what I call the wow factor. You got to sit back and go, we probably really did that.
I know what I do. Like he said, I don't know if it was a bombardier, one of them on the crew said, we made history. So they must know something more about it or not.
That's something. Arthur, how old are you now?
I'm 86.
All right, sir. My father just turned 87 2 days ago.
Well, congratulations.
And thanks for serving. Continued health to you, okay?
I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Arthur.
And thank you.
All right. That's it. Tom and Don, that's quite a story. It's quite the story from quite an individual.
And it was a story that we've heard since 1990 from another crew member on that very flight, and then a subsequent individual, and Felix Martucci, who was the bombardier who had recognized the mortician. When we found him, he wanted no part of us. He would slam the phone down. He would yell no. We even went to his apartment down in San Antonio and basically staked it out. We tried to catch him even there.
Let's talk about that nurse story that you two were telling us about before Arthur came in, who's quite a remarkable individual. I'm George Norrie. More of this incredible story. Witness to Roswell unmasking the government's biggest cover-up. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. So there was a nurse at a local hospital in Roswell, New Mexico, who apparently told the mortician, Glenn Dennis, about the bodies that she had seen. She was distraught. They were never able to verify the story on the Glenn Dennis end. And Tom and Don, let's let you pick it up because you say you think you have found the nurse, or you did find the nurse.
George, if you'll allow me, before Don picks up on the nurse story.
Okay.
Regarding the flight of the straight flush, as we call it, I just counted them up. There were 11 crew members on that flight. We attempted to locate everyone. We did locate all but just a few, and those we were not able to interview. you are presumed to be dead now. So we did try to locate everybody. And when Arthur mentioned that when they were all after the flight, they were gotten together and told that if you talk about it, you'll I think Art said you'll find yourself in Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. He meant Fort Leavenworth.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but anyway, there was also we also tried to, and we did locate the flight ops officer, the flight operations officer on that flight.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Edgar Skelly. And Don can tell this story that that we actually did interview him on a on, I think the most difficult type of interview to do is a cold interview where you go up and knock on your the person's door and introduce yourself. And you know, on our team, Don is that specialist, that he is the one that goes to the front door and does those interviews. And maybe Don can share you share with you and your audience what resulted with his interview with Edgar Skelly.
Okay, let's do that.
And I don't like to leave without getting some information. Once I'm there, in fact, we pinned him down in his home in Riverside, California. And he actually answered the door wearing a bathrobe, so he had to excuse himself to go dress. And as his wife led me into the front room, she knew who I was, and she kept saying, "You have to get him to talk. He needs to finally talk. Every time I see something on TV, I say, 'Honey, I know you were there. Why can't you tell me?' And he'll leave the room." So she saw this as one last effort. And he was a masterful dodger in that he always tried to change the subject on me.
Mm-hmm.
And he clearly, I mean, he's in the base yearbook. He was identified by all of these crewmen on that specific flight, Major Edgar Skelly. He was the one. And it always came back to, "I can't remember, I can't remember." And no matter what name I would throw out, "I can't remember." But then he always came back to me. "Now, why do you need to know about this? Why is this so important to you?"
And if he couldn't remember, why would he even ask that, right?
Precisely, precisely. And then he suggested, "Well, you know, I was in a minor car accident a few weeks ago. I hit my head, and I'm having a hard time remembering."
Ah,
but
yes.
Yet when I was finally leaving, and I asked him for a shortcut back to L.A., he knew exactly how to lay it out for me. So I said, "Well, thank God that car accident didn't cause any permanent damage." But what was interesting is that when I left, I asked his wife if I could have people such as Arthur and others on the crew actually call her, give her some ammunition, and possibly lead up to a confrontation, you know, directly with her husband.
Sure.
And she thought it was a wonderful idea. And I talked to, like, Robert Slusher, Lloyd Thompson, also on that flight. They agreed. I call her back some weeks later, and she says to me, "Don't ever call this number again. I am not to ever talk to you again."
Wow, she just turned on you.
Yes, exactly. So one can well imagine how she would have been read the riot act after we had left. So, again, and this was just in the last 10 years. So, again, what is, you know,
what's going on?
What's
for
going on after all this time that these people still live in such fear?
That's true. Now, and tell me now about the nurse, and then we'll move on. But
yeah, okay.
You've just got my curiosity on this story.
Well, and it was through a secondhand witness, someone who had actually worked at the Walker Airfield at the base hospital back around 1960, and she worked with a nurse, a fellow nurse, who suggested, well, or mentioned that, "Well, I was back here in 47 when the bodies came in from that flying saucer crash." And there wasn't much more said about it, but then Tom was the one who was the most instrumental in actually tracking down this very witness, this very woman. And we had a female investigator, Wendy Connors, actually go to the house when we located her. And she was especially interested in the affidavit that was shown her of Glenn Dennis. In fact, she wouldn't take her eyes off of it. She kept reading it. In fact, she even asked, was Glenn the one who told you about me?
Huh.
And this woman's name was Mary Lowe. We identify her in the book. We have her picture. And she just, wasn't me, wasn't there. Didn't matter what anybody else said. Didn't matter that there were witnesses to my making such comments of being involved.
Right.
And then the very afternoon, we confronted Glenn Dennis. And without so much as mentioning her name, he responded, oh, you mean Mary Lowe. She knows everything about this. So it caused us to step back and say, well, maybe Glenn wasn't misleading us. Maybe he, for whatever reason, gave us the wrong name. And I personally, I think Tom would agree, he was much closer to the nurse than he's ever been willing to let on to. His first wife is still alive, and he was married with a second wife at that time. But anyway, the next day, when we once again would confront Glenn, he retracted. He recanted. I never mentioned her. She wasn't involved. Don't ever bring it up again.
It's like somebody got to him, too.
Or she called him and said, how dare you? How could you possibly have betrayed that, you know, our confidence in this story? And end of story. We tried repeatedly after that. We know there were nurses involved. We've had other nurses who we've suspected. And amazingly enough, even the nurses in M squad, in the medical squad, in the yearbook, they all died rather young. Not that there was anything nefarious, involved there. But it must have been a hard life.
Unlike the Kennedy assassination, where all the witnesses seemed to disappear.
Huh? Right, correct. Yeah. But we had tracked down another nurse, who Rosemary McManus, in a nursing home before she passed away. And all she would say was that based on all the unknown doctors and nurses who literally stormed the base hospital, all of a sudden they just all showed up out of nowhere. She said clearly something big had happened.
Do you two see a smoking gun at all on this Roswell case?
Well, there are we talk about a smoking gun and the Holy Grail. To us, the smoking gun is the Ramey memo. This is the picture taken on July the 8th, 1947, of General Ramey kneeling with the weather balloon.
All the debris out there, right?
Yes.
Okay, I remember that. And he's holding something.
Yes. Okay. He's there were six or seven pictures taken at that press conference, and Ramey is in four of them, two by himself and two with his adjutant, Thomas DuBose, Colonel DuBose. And you can tell by the – he's holding a what appears to be a telex in his hand. He also is holding sunglasses in his other hand, which suggests that he had just come in from the outside and when someone handed him this telex.
Why did he put those down if he was posing for a picture? Or was it an impromptu-looking picture?
It looks like it was an impromptu type of thing. He just came in. They brought in the weather balloon. Okay, over here, General Ramey, we want a shot of you. Everything was moving quickly.
Bang, bang.
He still has his cap on, for that matter.
Yeah.
He still has his cap on. And so he's holding this telex. And, without modern computers and what have you, you couldn't read anything on that. You know, it's just something he's holding. But with the advent of computer software, I think Don and who was the doctor?
Dr. Richard Haynes.
Richard Haynes, around in the early 90s, tried to, just by extreme magnification, try to read the memo. And I think they were able to read just a few letters or maybe a word or two, but nothing that made any sense. But with modern computers and software, we are now able to read portions of that telex that he's holding in his hand, and it's not talking about a crashed weather balloon. It's talking about a crashed disc.
That's amazing.
It also mentions the dead aliens, the cadavers that were in the wreck that was forwarded to Fort Worth Army Airfield in Texas.
And it's in his hand.
Victims
in
of the wreck.
This is all in his hand. So we know the provenance, the origin of this memo. It's not something that a UFO buff cooked up. It's in a photograph that was taken by a photographer for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, J. Bond Johnson. We know the origin of this memo, and we can read the words, some of them, a good portion of them. And it's talking about the disc that was forwarded. It mentions the victims of the wreck. We know that if they had been military victims, they would have been called casualties, not victims. And weather balloons don't have victims, unless one landed on your head, I guess, and smothered you.
Yeah.
I don't know. But
I'd love to know where this telex is now. Huh?
You know, that's a good question, George. I have two possibilities on that. If Ravy didn't burn it, then who knows? Maybe he did. But
maybe he did.
We have had stories from neighbors of the Ramies that there's the proverbial trunk in his attic.
Oh, it still could be there.
Still could be there. If not, and we've never been able, we've never been to the Ramies' residence, but we've heard that story several times over of a trunk. Also, one involving a Blanchard, a trunk somewhere. Boy, wouldn't we like to, get a look at those. But
sure.
The other possibility is I talked to an author of a book on Pearl Harbor, and he spent 20 years in archives researching documents on regarding the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Spent 20 years. So I called him one time a few years ago. I explained about the telex, and I said, if it were you, where would you think that telex might wind up? What archive would that be in? And so he gave me a list of most probable to least probable, and I still have that list of where that telex, if it is archived, where it would be. So,
what a dramatic story that would be!
Absolutely,
oh my gosh.
Absolutely. It's talk that telex to us, and I think Don agrees, is a smoking gun. That's what we call the smoking gun of Roswell. It's just, it can't be talking about anything other than the Roswell crash. That's the only thing that makes sense.
Are there any children from Ramey that are out there that could talk about this?
Well, yes, but he hasn't. And, in fact, the son of General Ramey went through the museum a few years ago. In Roswell, yes. The UFO Museum in Roswell. And, Don, I think we are invited down, aren't we?
The door was left open, not directly invited, but we should stay in touch, and we've yet to take him up on such an invitation, but we really should. We really should.
Why isn't he saying much?
Well, I think, first of all, the general to this day, serves as the Snidely Whiplash, the sinister element as far as behind the cover-up of the entire incident. General Ramey, he's the one who had the weather balloon press conference. He's the one who, essentially let the air out of the Roswell flying saucer, so to speak.
Sure.
And his family, as a result, just by that name and anyone confronting them, having any background, any knowledge of the subject, they have this black eye, so to speak.
They can make it good, though.
They certainly could, absolutely. And though true to form, like Ramey would go on, for example, he was often referred to as the Air Force saucer man. He was always the spokesperson. Interestingly enough, he would become a consultant to the Air Force Project Blue Book on the subject. And yet he was one of their chief debunkers. He went out of his way for years trying to explain away the subject. In fact, as far as we can determine, he was also the instrument behind the entire ridicule factor. Days after the press conference at Fort Worth, he was on an El Paso radio program, and he was asked if that explained Roswell. Fine, but what about all the other sightings throughout the country? He agreed, yes, there had been sightings in every state throughout the country at that time, except for Kansas, which was a dry state.
Interesting.
And that came from Ramey.
Yeah.
And we've all had that knee-jerk, you know, we had that indoctrination since that, you know, people only over-imbibe see such things.
You two have done a great job with both the witness books, Witness to Roswell, Unmasking the 60-Year Cover-Up, and then, of course, Witness to Roswell, the Unmasking the Government's Biggest Cover-Up, which came out last year. I want to take some time after the break to talk about both those books because they flow together perfectly.
Thank you, George.
Do you think we'll get the bottom line answer to Roswell? Is anybody ever going to come forward and just solve this for us? And I don't mean reporters like you two and investigators, but some government official?
Someone that is either a participant or a corollary in the same, in a place to know. My answer is no. I don't think that's going to happen. I think as we stated before, the government is not ever going to come clean on this case. And whoever would think about that would also have to think about their career. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think that what we're doing is we're putting this case together one witness at a time. Most of the information we get, that's just in little snippets. We don't get that person that sort of knows the whole picture. That person hasn't appeared. And we don't think that person is going to appear. So we have to do it like we are. And the moment we get an incontrovertible piece of physical evidence, and we are looking hard for that, we will hold a press conference on that.
And, super.
And come
on this program.
Absolutely.
We're going to be back in a moment. We'll have Tom and Don tie together their two works of Witness to Roswell. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Tom and Don, tie together your two works, Witness to Roswell, Witness to Roswell, with two subtitles, of course.
Yes. I would. First, I'm going to give ourselves a little pat on the back.
Oh, good. You deserve it.
our two books, the first one came out in 2007, Witness to Roswell, Uncovering the 60-Year Cover-Up. And that book it became the number one selling UFO book in the world for the next 2 years, 2007 and 2008. So in those 2 years, we had accumulated new information, right? A lot were still on the case. So we decided to do a second edition, expanded and updated, and revised with new chapters and other chapters revised and updated. And I called our publisher this past week to find out how it's doing. And it came out last year in 2009, and it is right now among the top-selling UFO books in the world as we speak.
Good for you.
The feedback we're getting on it, starting with the first book and then continuing into the second book, is that we hear this over and over and over again, that it's the best book on Roswell ever written. And we thank you, George, for contributing to the second book.
Oh, that was my pleasure. When you both asked me to do that, it was a delight, and I'm glad that worked out for both of you.
Well, we certainly appreciate it.
Now, You've segmented the unmasking. 2007, Witness came out first, Witness to Roswell, then the second one, Witness to Roswell, Unmasking the Government's Biggest Cover-Up, in 2009, as you've said. tell me the difference between the two in the direction you both took with it.
Well, as the investigation has even developed in these past 20 years, it's been this mosaic, this puzzle of, piecing each individual witness testimony into the whole, general historic event. And as even conceived with both books, we felt that in the past we had merely presented the information. We had filled in a lot of those voids, a lot of speculation on our part. And here we allowed the witnesses to just speak for themselves, just as we had with Arthur in the first segment. And give you an example, even leading up to, that particular flight, the Straight Flush, and how we piece things together.
I love that name, by the way, for a plane.
The Straight Flush. Well,
I never seem to get any of them, but that's okay.
But if we recall the original testimony of the rancher, Mac Brazel, and his description to KGFL radio reporter Frank Joyce about it being horrible, and finally he said the smell, the stench, it was just horrible. Well, that's a common, as even describing the nurse with Glenn Dennis, the smell, the overwhelming odor that was coming from the cadavers. And then the need to remove the carcasses as far away from the base as possible before they were, flown out, as described on the Straight Flush, as we've now surmised. But there was a corporal, he was a Native American by the name of Edward Harrison, who we interviewed. And he was in charge of a small detachment of Native Americans, and they were ordered to report. This was the night before the Straight Flush flew out, and they were ordered to report to the far southwest corner of the base of the tarmac, way down as far removed from the general base operation area as possible. And they had a special duty assignment, as they were told, and it was at the very time of the incident, and that's how we were able to piece it precisely in that timeline the night before. Well, anyway, they were surprised that when they came to the site, they were met by none other than their very commanding officer, who was Lieutenant Colonel John Loomis of the 1027th Air Material Squadron. Well, anyway, he was sitting in a parked Jeep in front of an erected 8-foot-tall wire fence, a chain-link fence. And inside the fence was an army tent. And what was so surprising to them was it had not been there before. Here it was, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And he was basically told to post a guard, and they were told by Colonel Loomis, shoot anything that isn't a rabbit, as he put it. This wasn't unusual for the nature of the base with the atomic bomb and everything. But again, what was unusual was the fact that here was this fence with this tent inside it. And he would leave. He would leave his guard behind and then return back the next morning with more guards to relieve them. And the fence is gone. The tent is gone. The guards are gone. And the only thing left were heavy tire tracks, aircraft tire tracks, that circled around the soft ground. And which direction were they headed? Towards the bomb pits. And then we have, as far as that crate actually loaded up the very next, that very same afternoon.
I mean, that crate story is incredible. This the security around it and everything else.
Precisely. And again, but piecing it all together, the chain of events, and it clearly suggests something truly extraordinary.
I think so too. You had in the sequel, The Witness to Roswell, the one that just came out, you've got a number of players that you've been talking to and following that all add something to the story. Let's go through some of them real quickly, okay? The Air Force hitman again, Hunter Penn, sent to
Roswell. Yes, Hunter Penn. Now, when this occurred, the as far as the military was concerned, it was easy to contain the story. They shipped certain airmen out to other bases. They held meetings in hangars of the entire squadron in some cases, and the commander would get up there and say, "Fellas, whatever you think is going on isn't going on." And if you want to read about it, you can read about it in Leavenworth. So the message was clear not to talk ever about this again. The problem was the controlling the civilians who were either eyewitnesses or who knew about the bodies, especially in some way.
Were there many people?
Well, yes. Normally in rural New Mexico, when there's an air crash, the civilians get there first. They pocket souvenirs and what have you. And yes, there were many civilians that got to the there were three crash sites, as we believe, and quite a number of them got to one or more of those.
And what do you think happened, by the way? How could these objects come from gosh knows how many light years away, probably in a mothership, I would guess. But what happened to them? How did they crash?
Well, that question is often asked, George. How could it come from Alpha Centauri, let's say, all the way to Earth, only to crash? How could that happen? Well, the answer is we don't know. We can speculate that based on witness testimony, starting with Mac Brazel and some of his neighbors, that there was a heavy thunder and lightning storm on the evening of July the 3rd, 1947. And if you've ever been in New Mexico at this time, you've never seen lightning like this. At least I haven't, coming from the Philadelphia area. I've never seen lightning like this. And so Mac and a few of the neighbors thought they heard an explosion that wasn't a thunderclap. It was different than a thunderclap, but they thought they heard an explosion during this thunder and lightning storm. Well, the next day, Mac goes out to check his fence, check his sheep, and there he finds this field full of strange debris. And they're all, they're of different types. Many are rigid that you can't bend them or do anything to them. Others are things that you can wad up, pieces of what looks like metal, but you can wad it up in your hands and hold it over a flat surface and let it go, and it'll flatten out before it hits the surface. So the speculation, George, at least I think Don and I agree with this, is that it was struck by lightning. The craft, whatever it was made out of, exceeded its tensile strength and came apart. And there was an inner cabin that was not breached, and it was the inner cabin that finally wound up closer to Roswell, and we call that the impact site. That's not the site that Brazel found, but the final resting place of the inner cabin or escape capsule or whatever you want to call it. But we think it was lightning. We've heard stories about, it was shot down, and we have no evidence of that.
No, not at all. Now, you talk about in the book how Mac Brazel's daughter recants her story. What happened there? That was what, Bessie Brazel?
Yes, Bessie would become one of the star witnesses, along with counterintelligence officer Sheridan Cabot, in their Mogul report in September of 1994. And what was interesting is that after we first interviewed her back in 1989, she already was in a bit of a dispute with her own brother, Bill Jr., about whether she was even there or not. And I remember after we first talked to her, and then I immediately went back to her brother, and he shouted right into the phone, "What is she talking about? She wasn't even there." And I caught her in a number of contradictions, because at the time she was a 14-year-old, teenage girl, and they had their main house down in Tularosa, New Mexico, where her mother, her rest of her family resided. And Mac was simply the ranch foreman up in the Corona area. And the ranch house didn't have electricity, no running water, no telephone, no TV, no radio, nothing. What would a teenage girl be spending the summer up at such a place when she had a regular home?
Yeah, exactly. She'd be bored out of her mind.
Precisely. So we kept coming back to her, and then she even finally sat down with her own brother. And before she passed away, and, you know, concerning a number of other circumstances involving the family, as far as this, the feeling that they are still being watched, that they still receive as far as threatening phone calls even up to this day, she finally accepted the fact that it was a separate incident altogether. They were constantly picking up weather balloons on that ranch. And at times she would spend some time with her dad. And they would gather up. They'd go out and gather up wreckage and balloon material, because cattle and sheep are like goats. They'll eat anything, you know, in their path. So as the foreman, he was responsible for their well-being, and they would clean things up. So I don't know if it's a case of just trying to, you know, get a little publicity, but we had even paid her a visit up in Portland, Oregon, on one occasion, and even her own husband at that time said that, "I'm sure she's not talking about the same incident." And she finally did recant. She finally agreed that she was not there, and that whatever her father had recovered had really destroyed him, that he was never the same person as a result.
No, once you see something like that, you become a different person.
And that might describe her reaction, her behavior in all this, because she was attempting to still get her dad back. She was trying to trivialize it. She was trying to suggest that there wasn't any reason for his behavior, and yet deep inside she knew there was. She just couldn't explain. She couldn't put her finger on it, and God knows she couldn't get him to talk about it.
Tell me about the story of the so-called midget in the jailhouse that surprised the JAG officer. This is something.
This was a story that was told to us about 3 years ago. I think the lead came into the museum, if I recall. And the story is that there was a JAG officer that's I forget what that stands for, Judge Advocate General.
Judge Advocate General. That's
yeah,
right.
A lawyer, an Air Force lawyer, Army Air Force
or
lawyer.
Or Navy, same thing.
Yeah. And he was given orders. He was in Washington, practicing his trade in Washington, and he was given orders to fly to Roswell, New Mexico. And this was at the time just after the incident. And so, you know, okay, yes, sir. And so he flies to Roswell, and he deplanes there, and he's taken over to the hangar where he can still see some of this wreckage in the hangar that they brought in from the crash sites, bunch of wreckage. And she says, that's interesting. And so he's then taken over to the guardhouse. And so he figures, oh boy, I'm here to defend somebody, you know, an airman who was misbehaving. So that's what he thought. So he goes in, and they lead him into one of the holding tanks there. And here is this little, he called it a little man, you know, three and a half feet tall in this fatigue. They had him in a fatigue. Army fatigues that just were way too big for him.
Was he proportioned?
Well, he between the shock and the camouflage, he was in the army fatigues that were way too big for him. So he couldn't really judge proportions other than the large head. That's what stood out, was the large head. And he can't believe this. It's also wearing a fatigue type hat. So it's got part of its head covered up, but he can see the overwhelming feature here is a large head on a very small body. And he's looking at this. His mouth is open. And all of a sudden, one of the other airmen comes in. Whoa, whoa, I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry, sir. You're not who we thought you were. They were expecting somebody else to come over, and they somehow misappropriated this JAG fellow and took him in to view this, thinking he was somebody else.
So now they didn't know what to do with him, right?
So they quickly got him out of there, and he didn't know what was going on, but years later he described this gray as what it was. Now we know that one was still alive. From all the witness testimony from eyewitnesses who were at the impact site.
Were there three total or four total?
We believe, and I think Don will back me up on this, there was a minimum total of four that included one that was alive, and a maximum of seven that included one that was alive.
Okay.
Because there were two, two sites where bodies were found. There were bodies found at, we call it the D. Proctor site. It's a site 2.5 miles east of the Mac Brazel site, where we believe when that ship exploded, we believe it was struck by lightning, where when it exploded, two or three bodies were ejected. They weren't in the inner cabin. They were somewhere else in the ship, and they went down with all the wreckage that was found on Brazel's field. But they were ejected at a time where they were 2.5 miles east. The other site where bodies were found, and the one that was alive, was the impact site, which was about 30 miles north of Roswell, many miles from the impact
site.
All
right. This is an incredible story, and we're going to take calls with both of you next on Coast to Coast AM. Tom and Don, do you two get along all the time, or do you ever have a disagreement or two?
I think pretty much. I think we're almost in 100% agreement, as you know, on the Roswell, you know, on the facts of the case and what they mean. I can't think of any disagreements right now.
How come both of you still keep at this Roswell case? You don't give up. How come?
Well, as we've often described it, as the granddaddy of not only all UFO cases, but as we mentioned earlier, it would be the biggest story of the millennium. And I find it interesting and rather amusing that the constant effort on the part of the debunkers. I mean, here Tom and I are, we would say it's beyond a belief, it's becoming a conviction. But yet it's still an ongoing investigation. It remains very fluid. We are still going in whatever direction the witnesses take us, and that's precisely has been our methodology from the very beginning. And yet, when we complete this preoccupation, this obsession, I guess, on our part, we're done. We'll go on to something much more simpler, such as cancer research or something. But unlike the debunkers, if they are 100% convinced it didn't happen, that it was merely a mogul balloon of sorts, why do they continue to engage us? Why do they continue the damage control? Why debate us over and over again if the victory is won, if the war has been won? So I feel that they also know that as long as we are proactive, as long as we are still making every effort to come to a final resolution as to what actually did happen, and it's also keeping in mind the government is now up to four official explanations.
They keep changing their minds.
They keep changing their mind. They're stalling for time. And as you had mentioned at the beginning of the show, George, the attrition rate, as we are losing more and more of the World War II generation,
yes.
And I'm sure that is their game plan, to run out the clock, to stall for time until that final witness is passed on and it becomes cover-up complete.
Out of sight. Out of mind.
Precisely, and that's where, as long as there is a single witness still out there breathing his last, her last, we have to try to get to them. We have to provide them with an opportunity to finally go on the record. One of the reasons we're getting more and more of the deathbed testimonies, all admissible in a court of law for that matter. And yet, if we don't do it, who will?
You know, one other thing, George, as serious a matter as this is, and it is, we've been able to maintain, I believe, a sense of humor throughout. If you can't do something without maintaining a sense of humor, you know, it can you become overly obsessed. And while we're interested in this case, I wouldn't say that we're obsessed with it. Yes, it's the only case that we've been investigating for 20 years, but it's not an obsession to the point where, you know, you get exasperated and can't sleep and you know, things like that. It's I think we maintain a good perspective on it, and
a healthy balance where we are able to bounce theories, ideas, speculations off of one another, and that's what makes also for a productive team.
Absolutely.
And that we're not just lone individuals who, and I use that word obsession, suggesting, as the old saying, we men on a mission do tend to become rather fanatical, because our loved ones, our social lives, many of our friendships take a back seat. That's not necessarily an obsession as much as we're on a mission, and it's not a hobby. It's beyond a labor of love. It's a commitment. And we're going to follow through with it. We're going to finish it.
Good for you. Let's take some calls. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, we go. First-time caller. Steve, you're on with Tom and Don. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Hey,
hi, Steve. How's it going?
Good.
Very good. I have a very interesting story to tell you that was told to me when I was a child. I'm 38 now, so this was like in the 80s. I grew up in a military family. My father was a CID agent in the Army, stationed up in New Jersey. One of his really, really good friends from college was stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and he was an OSI agent, which is Office of Special Intelligence. He told my father some time ago, and subsequently was passed down to me, that one day when he was at Wright Field, since he had a very high top-secret clearance, he was told to deliver a package to a particular hangar that everybody around the base pretty much knew was kind of like the Roswell places where they kept it. And it was like the buzz was always in the air around Wright Field. And he had the opportunity to deliver a package down to it. And the story that was told to me was that he went into this hangar that had a shaft that went down underground. And to deliver this particular package, he met with some people down there. And while he was there, he saw 4 dead aliens in formaldehyde bottles. He also said he saw, but there were 2 ships. Now, whether you were saying that maybe one ship split in half, maybe it was 2 parts of one ship or 2 separate ships, but that he said that they had
subsequent events, yes.
It could have been something separate. But there was, he thought were 2, and he did see 4 dead aliens, about 4 feet tall-ish, that looked, he said they were like childlike, like, you know, 12-year-old adolescents, kind of very human-esque. With big heads and gray skin. They're in formaldehyde bottles. He also went on to say that we're not the only people that have one, that Russia also has one too. So off the air, I will gladly give you his name if you want to try to contact him. He's been long out of the service. You know,
by all means, that was the very thing we were going to ask, if we could have you leave your contact information with the producer off the air.
Okay.
Yes, make sure you do, because I think last time, Don, correct me, we had a lady call, and we requested it. I don't think it was gotten.
Okay, we're good. We've got him on hold. Tom will get the number, and he'll get it to both of you, okay?
Wonderful. Yes, thank you for your story. We've heard a number of stories along these lines about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. In fact, one that I received this week, I interviewed the person, and he said that he was a test pilot, not a test pilot, but a trainer, a pilot trainer at the Wright Pat in the 60s. And it was said amongst his crew that there were 4 dead aliens at the base. And I asked him, I said, now, was this said in jest, or was this serious? He says, oh, no, this was serious. And that's all he knew. This is the snippet that I'm telling you about. That's all he knew, was that it was common knowledge amongst his compatriots that there were four dead aliens at the right field, but he didn't know any more than that.
Now, at what point do you think they brought these bodies from Fort Worth, which is probably where Arthur and his group carried them to, and then got them over to Wright-Patterson? How much time do you think
There were two flights, George. The first one was the Pappy Henderson flight, and the C-54 cargo plane went out on July the 8th. Okay, this is the same day as the press conference with General Ramey. They went directly to Wright Pat on July the 8th. The next flight, the second and last flight, was the following day on July 9th. That's the flight that Arthur Osipchuk was on that went from Roswell to Fort Worth. We believe the bodies were kept there overnight and then flown to Wright Pat the next day. The one that was still alive, the experience of the JAG officer suggests that it was kept on the Roswell base for a while. And interestingly, when someone didn't want to be found on the base, they always went to the guardhouse. Like Blanchard told the press that he went on, you know, as soon as this story hit, he put out the press release that he was going on leave. Well, what he did is he hid out in the guardhouse. So,
well, that was innovative, right?
Yes. So that's why the story the gentleman just told rings. It rings a bell with us, because we've heard stories like this before. And also the underground portion. He mentioned that they went underground. The late Leonard Stringfield, who had access to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, actually identified the building where all the Roswell stuff was kept. He called it the Pink Building, and it was one or two stories above ground, but everything else was underground. So this, you know, these things all seem to come together.
Absolutely. Next up, let's go to Christian in Los Angeles. Hey, Christian, welcome to the program.
How are you guys doing?
Okay, all is well. All
right, yeah, I just want to say I have a couple of things. I have one story to relate. Something that occurred to me about probably 3 or 4 years ago. I live in L.A., and to make a long story short, we've had a gentleman who lives in our apartment complex here who is an Army veteran. He was a full bird colonel. He's still alive. And everybody calls him the Colonel, and he's a Korean and Vietnam War veteran, and I've always heard that he had something to do with Army intelligence. So one day, it was probably about 3 years ago, I asked him a question. I said, look, Colonel, I watched this thing on the History Channel last night about the Roswell incident. I kind of wanted to test him because I had a feeling he probably knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, well, what do you think about the Roswell incident? And right before I could finish with what I was saying, he cut me off, and you could, like, literally the air was so thick you could cut it with a knife.
Yeah, he just turned his personality on you, didn't he?
And he became kind of very hostile because he didn't expect me to ask this, and he basically said, oh, look, I do know about what happened back in 47. There was a crash, and it was a terrible tragedy. We went out there. And, you know, just the bodies, yes, we did find bodies, and it was just such a terrible, terrible tragedy that all those poor little things, he died, and don't ever ask me about this ever again. I can't ever talk about it. Do you understand? Turns around, executes a 90-degree about face, and walks away from me. And I've never mentioned anything with UFOs, you know, to him since. So like you said, with many of these people who were part of, you know, that generation, I mean, obviously, it's like the people who were in the military, absolutely. Whenever you ask anybody in the military about UFOs, especially Roswell, I mean, it's like you stick a hot coal under their butt. They absolutely clam up. They can't say anything. Another thing I wanted to ask, because this is the second time that I've spoken to both of the gentlemen who are on tonight's show, and I want to say, again, thank you for all the diligent work. Because
investigators.
This has to be exposed. And you know, the truth has to be told, because obviously we're not alone in the universe. My second thing was, I'll hurry up, with the alien that was alive, that was recovered, Was there, did the Army take or whisk it away and to, let's say, an interrogation center? And was there, a great deal learned from it? Because I go on the Internet and I read all of this weird, strange stuff that, you know, the aliens started essentially spill the beans that, you know, and all that. So, I mean, was the alien interrogated? And I also heard that maybe 4 or 5 years after the Roswell incident, that apparently it was actually referred to as EBE, that it died. So anyway, I just want to say keep it work, gentlemen. And also I would like to know, how do I contact you? It's like with your books, do you have like an email or something I can, like, let's say, email you or something?
Sure, through your website. And let's give that website out, Tom.
Yeah, it's our website is www.roswellinvestigator, that's all one word, .com. www.roswellinvestigator.com. Also, in the back of our book, do you have our book?
Go ahead.
Is the gentleman there?
He's there somewhere.
In the back of our book is all the contact information. There's a phone number. It has both Don and my email addresses, and again the website address. So you can get that information from the back of our book or by going on www.roswellinvestigator. The question I had for the gentleman was, I don't think he gave a name for the officer. Does he remember the name of the officer, the colonel?
You know, I don't. But, you know, if I try and contact you guys, I will, and I'll mention that I called you so you can, like, that'll ring a bell. But everybody calls him the colonel. I don't know his full name, but I can find that out for you.
Could you please, because even without violating a confidence on your part,
right,
if it could in any way be arranged that we have a moment with him or even pay him a visit, it still comes back to why do these, especially officers, and we spoke to an officer just a few weeks ago again, and he made the very snide remark, well, you boys know the officers will never tell you the truth about what really happened out there. And they have the, you know, the biggest, stake in all this. I mean, their pensions being what they are and the heavy fines as far as, but you describe something, I think the best example would be the late Senator Barry Goldwater. And George, certainly knowing of the situation and his confrontation with the late chair of the Joint Chiefs.
Oh, yeah, and they wouldn't tell him anything.
General
they basically
Curtis
said, LeMay, Senator, it's none of your business.
That's right. And LeMay telling him, and if you ever bring this up again, I will personally see that you're court-martialed. Now, that's to a brig general in the United States Air Force Reserves to begin with, and a former presidential candidate.
Tell me in the just moments we have before the break, and then we'll go back to final calls, about this photojournalist story. What was his name? Alan Grant?
Yes. Alan Grant was a life photographer. Remember, before
life,
TV.
Life magazine was it. That and Look.
Yes. Before TV, the only way people could see what was happening was through these large photo type magazines, Life, Look, what have you. And he had just transferred to the LA office from New York because he wanted to be on the movie scene, you know?
Yep.
And he got a call from the office in New York to get out to New Mexico I think they said the meteor had crashed. That was the story, that a meteor had crashed, and he was supposed to go out there and photograph it. And so he gets into a plane, flies to Albuquerque, where he's met by I believe it's a captain or major, I don't remember his rank, and there's a single-engine aircraft waiting, already running, waiting for him. And so they get in the plane, and out they fly into the New Mexico desert. And Don knows this. New Mexico has a lot of aircraft runways throughout the state. You know, it's not like international runways, but, you know, local aircraft runways. And they landed on one after a flight of, maybe a half hour or so. And there's a Jeep waiting for them. And he goes over to the Jeep, and the pilot says, "Wait a second, sir, you're going to need this." And he hands him a revolver. It's a 45 automatic with a holster that he puts around his waist. He says, "What do I need this for?" And he says, I'm not sure, but I think you ought to have it." Now, that would worry me, you know, what I was getting into.
Especially if he wasn't trained in how to use it, huh?
Yes. And there are pictures of him on this trip, and you can see the gun around his waist. And he's, you know, posing in front of the airplane, then posing in front of the Jeep, taken at the time. And so off they go into the desert. And his story is they drove out there for about a half an hour, and they didn't find anything. And back they come, and they get back on the plane, and they fly back to Albuquerque, and then he flies home.
And that's it?
And that was it. And for years he was, what was that all about? What was that all about? And so he didn't know anything at the time about the Roswell crash, but...
I'll let you finish that when we come right back, and then we'll take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Back at you now on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, tomorrow night, Nightline, ABC's Nightline, tentatively plans to run our special segment that they did a few weeks ago. They're ready to go. It's in the can. I talked to the producer today via email, and he said it looks great. And it is scheduled to run tomorrow night, Thursday night, barring any breaking news story that could push us off for another day or two. So plan to watch it and give me a little fast blast feedback, if you would. Okay, Tom and Don, let's get back to that Life magazine story. So he's out there in the desert. He's got the 45. Nothing happens. He leaves. What happens then?
He gets back to the office in L.A. Now, this occurred at the exact time of the Roswell recovery of the UFO and what was going on there. So he tells the story, and the other people in the office said, "Well, did you shoot any aliens?" And they ribbed him about that for years. And the story suggests to me that at first blush that maybe the Air Force did send him out there to take photographs, et cetera, et cetera, but maybe they changed their mind in midstream, you know,
mm-hmm.
They called it off, and so that's why they turned around and went back, and he didn't see anything. But the real solution to this conundrum is that his wife, who also worked for Life magazine in the same office, I think she supplies the most cogent explanation for this. She says that what would be better than when other magazines start getting interested in this story, what's better than the Air Force telling them, well, Life magazine is already on it, so you don't have to send anybody out there. So she believes it was a cover to...
They used him. They framed him, basically.
They used him, absolutely. And he died just a few years ago. And on his deathbed, he believed, finally, that he was used and that this really was the Roswell story that involved something very extraordinary that they wanted to cover up. So that is, I believe, the solution to this story is what his widow said.
Okay, let's go back to the final calls now. We'll go to Murrayville, Illinois, east of the Rockies. Hey, Ron, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
George, in 2002, I visited the museum in Roswell, and I was privileged to talk in person, privately, with Mr. Glenn Dennis. And I just happened to be in there. I saw him walk in, and I walked right up to him and introduced myself. And then, I don't know, he grabbed me and took me off more to a private part of the museum and actually spoke with me for 2 hours.
What did you think of him?
Well, he was very real. I felt that this person was real, and we were just talking about normal things at first. And then, of course, I asked him about Roswell. His demeanor completely changed, kind of like the previous caller said about the colonel.
Mm-hmm.
When he started talking about Roswell, altogether different and much more serious. He recounted the story, of course, of the mysterious lady that he told me that he had met her afterwards. He had been trying to find her, and all of a sudden, you know, like she was gone. And then he got a message from her to meet her at some local place, maybe like a drugstore or something in Roswell, and a restaurant. And he met her, and she was scared to death. She couldn't say anything, but that she drew on a napkin what she had seen. Well, he kept that napkin, he told me, and had supposedly had it hidden away for years, and he was never going to show it to anybody. But anyway, the nurse, she suddenly was gone, and he told me he never saw her ever again.
You think something happened to her?
Well, he never found out. He said he never knew what happened to her. He knew who she was. He had never given her name to anyone. And I felt like then that on, you know, some other stories that I've heard, but now here I'm getting it firsthand.
Sure. Well, much like what Don and Tom have uncovered, isn't it? Very similar, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. You know, I mean, firsthand from Mr. Dennis in that, well, you know, maybe he tells me something, maybe he tells somebody else something a little different to always constantly maybe cover his tracks. But I really felt like, you know, this man is sincere. Something very traumatic happened to him, you know, during this time. And I've always felt like that he was kind of a peripheral player, if you will, but yet he was involved with it.
Well, he was a civilian, though he did have, as far as a front gate clearance, as far as cooperating with the base hospital. One of the things that we certainly made every effort to do, even beyond the nurse, was just establish the request for the children's caskets. And a colleague of ours had actually talked to the son of the contracted truck driver who actually made that run up to Amarillo, Texas, to quickly pick up a number of children's caskets. And his father commenting upon returning back from the base where they were delivered, Casper the Ghost. They were talking about Casper the Ghost. And that was, at times, the very name that was even used in reference to the bodies at that time, Casper the Ghost, based on their larger head and pale ashen gray skin appearance. We've had other witnesses that said immediately following the event, they were being told about the phone calls. They were being told about the request for the children's casket. A former chief of police in Roswell by the name of Hall verified that, for example, that within days he was told about the strange phone calls. So there are many witnesses to that effect. Then we spoke to a former sergeant by the name of Leroy Lang, who even claimed that he had trained specifically that very nurse as far as radioactivity, radiation poisoning. And so there have been enough other people in the peripheral talking about the nurse and the mortician. Might make a good movie sometime, I suppose,
yeah,
down the road.
It would.
But it isn't just Glenn Dennis. It isn't just Glenn Dennis.
Okay, thank you. Fairmont, West Virginia, let's go to Jimmy. Jimmy, you're on.
Hi, George. Good evening.
Sure.
Hi. And gentlemen, good to speak with you.
Thank you, Jimmy.
And by the way, thanks for some new data on this question. Every little bit of information that comes in is welcome. But your crewman on the B-29 earlier, he stated that he was 20 years old when he entered the military in 1941.
And he said he was around 26.
When the
event happened.
And that's 63 years ago, and he said he was 86. 63 plus 26 in
89. So we're off
89.
By maybe he was off by 3 years. You know,
I was just saying.
When he came
just,
in, yeah.
Well, he said he was 86.
Yeah, he's 86 now. I would back it. He probably went in maybe 17, 18 years old.
George?
Yeah.
I spent 6 years in the military. I know my ETS dates in and out, and I'll guarantee that every service person listening to me right now goes, yeah, I know my ETS dates. So it's just...
Well, he's 88.
Yeah, he's 86.
But he's 86.
Hey,
yeah.
My great-grandma in Sicily lived to be 108 years old, was running a household until the end. So,
yep.
You know, you never know. But, he was a little off on Leavenworth there when he said Fort Worth. I knew he meant Leavenworth.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But can we document his being at Roswell? Absolutely. He is in the base yearbook. He is in the very squadron section of that particular, the 393rd, along with those other crewmen. So, yes, we can put him.
Well, you know why I believe his story, Jimmy, Tom, and Don, more than anything? He could have said, I saw little bodies in this thing. He didn't say that. I mean, he said, you know what? They kept us away. There was something in there. We're sure. He speculated. But, you know, he didn't give us a tale or a yarn. He just
also have the other crewmen on the flight who, even before Arthur, were describing those very same details.
Yep. He just laid it out the way he saw it, the way it happened to him. Let's go next to Utah, first-time caller. Shane, good morning.
Hi.
Hey.
It's good to talk to you. Hey, I got I had an aunt, and you guys haven't mentioned this, and I don't know if this is pertinent or not, but she worked with Cordell Hull as a stenographer during World War II.
Okay.
And the same thing basically happens. I found out about this, so I went and asked her about, hey, you know, about the World War II stuff, is anything, and she kind of, she was very hesitant and said, yeah, you know, I remember everything came across my desk, but, you know, I'm not really at liberty to talk about it. And this was back in 98, and this is forever. And so I went back a couple times, talked to her, and she kind of told me about a little story about Cordell Hull. I don't know if it was the firsthand or if it was secondhand or whatever, but she said something about that he had visited Roswell and that something happened, but telepathic, something with the alien was still alive, and then right after that he was hospitalized, and then he died shortly after.
Huh.
I confess I've never heard of the Cordell Hull story. In fact, my only recollection of him, you know, through the media and reading is with, you know, Pearl Harbor and World War II. I haven't heard the story the gentleman has just told to us. Don, have you ever heard of?
No. We've heard of cryptographers who were even at the base years later who came across telexes, wire transmissions, that type of thing. But as far as his even going to Roswell, no, we had never heard that.
More, there must be, even though you two have done an incredibly thorough job, I would guess there's still some pieces of the puzzle out there, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why we're still on this. And every little piece that we get, it's either it fits into something we've already established, which is worth something also, or it's a nuance or a new little piece. And that's how we built this case. That's how we determined the extent of the threats. Up until we got on this in the late 90s, we knew that, they kept Mac Brazel sequestered and, they got in the face of others. But the extent to which they threatened life and limb was new to us.
Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina on the Skype line. We've got Jim. Go ahead, Jim.
Hey, guys. Depending on how ancient you guys are right now, we used to appear on some of the same shows back in the early 80s, such as Bill Jenkins out in L.A.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've watched you guys through the years, and I got to say, the only legitimate, in my opinion, the only legitimate investigators when it comes to this story. And what's becoming apparent to me is that the story is getting clearer, and this is a challenge for you guys. I recognize this. You have witnesses that are passing away. The truth is the story gets clearer and clearer as the years go on. And I want to commend you guys. My research was based on strange objects on the moon. And quite honestly, it started to take over my life, and I put it away so that I could live a life, you know, raise a family. Most people out there don't understand when you take this on as a lifelong ambition, it takes over your life. And I certainly hope you guys have reserved a portion of your life for your family and your friends, because it does become an obsession. I know you don't want to use that word, But the truth is, we all know it becomes an obsession.
Of course it does, because we find ourselves each day, if we don't feel as though we've devoted some time, as though we haven't accomplished something regarding the case, there's that guilt. It's the time is, as Tom said earlier, the case is flashing before us, and we have to grab that brass ring before it's out of reach. And the pressure is there. But you are correct, Jim, that we have to live lives. We have to step back and also retain that outside perspective. Otherwise, we get so caught up in it that we lose our focus. We lose our objectivity.
Tom or Don, has anybody tried to decode whatever those inscriptions were on that piece of metal?
Well, I believe the answer to that is yes. We don't know the answer, of course, but there's a story out of Wright-Patterson that there was a fellow called in to do just what you said, try to decode the inscriptions.
I wonder what it said. I wonder if it said to serve man.
Yeah. Good old Rod Serling.
You right? Never know. You never know, but that would have been fascinating to find
or,
out what said.
Or Brett Favre threw another interception, something
yeah,
like that.
Something. You never know.
You know, when we were talking earlier.
Earth or bust.
You know? Talking earlier as far as ever solving this riddle, ever, you know, bringing this to fruition. And we can't emphasize enough that this even exceeds the Oval Office. We could take the, you know, former presidents, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, and then throw in Senator Barry Goldwater and the late Congressman Stephen Schiff, and even add the current governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson.
And a little bit of Ronald Reagan.
Exactly. And they would all lament the fact that they, too, were not able to get the answers regarding this, that it's something that even exceeds their level of office. And I think that should be frightening to every man, woman, and child in this country, not just because it pertains to UFOs, but the idea that there are secret keepers that exist within the secret world, and we don't elect them. We have no control over them, but yet they're controlling us. And to me, that's frightening.
And the other caller, I mean, has this consumed a lot of your life, both of you?
Well, it's the I've got my life pretty I'm retired now, and this is one of the regular items on my plate. There are other things on my plate, but this is one of them.
Yeah.
And it is a labor of love, I have to say that. I still get a chill down my back when I get a new witness or read something or get something that is that we're looking for.
Sure.
It's not an obsession where I, you know, wring my hands and pound the table, and you know, it's just one of the interests in my life. It's a big one, but it's one of several.
And I believe Tom, same for you.
Well, that was Tom, but
okay.
Well,
that was me.
But George,
you're twins sometimes.
Just a quick postscript to even the last time.
And I've got 30 seconds left.
Go ahead. Were on. A listener overheard our mentioning of a particular witness. And she called out to her husband. They're talking about so-and-so. And as a result, we were placed in contact with her. She provided additional first-hand information, which led to the family. And it affords us, you know, these opportunities that every time people know we're out there, if they're willing to contact us to talk, it, again, provides pieces of the puzzle.
The website, RoswellInvestigator.com. That's how you can get a hold of Don Schmidt and Tom Carey. Thank you both for your work. Fantastic. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.